Are you interested in improving your procurement and negotiation skills and understanding? Well, this is the podcast for you. The Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph.
Well, welcome to another edition of the Procurement Podcast with me, Andy Franks from Bright Sky Clear Mind, and Christoph Barrière-Varjou from BVW Global.
Andy, how are you? It's been a little while since the last podcast. I think it's good to speak with you again.
Yeah, likewise. Not much has happened in the last 18 months of procurement, has it, to be honest? I mean,
No. The market has been going super well and, you know, no issue at all.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, of course, we're very keen to find out and discuss, and the purpose of this particular podcast is for us to go through some of the highlights and the headlines of the way procurement has responded not only to the pandemic but to also the coming out of the pandemic and the potential growth and supply chain challenges that we're all experiencing. It's as we're recording this, fuel shortages in the United Kingdom. And across the globe, there are challenges that are being met in terms of shipping and, you know, general freight issues. And I thought, well, you and I both thought, didn't we, Christoph, that it would be a good idea to try and get a head round some of the challenges and also extend an invitation out to the people who listen to the Procurement Podcast and for you to get in touch with us. And we'll give details at the end of the podcast on how you can do that, on the way you've coped with the procurement challenges over the past 18 months, 2 years, and to really give a broader understanding of what people are coming up against, particularly in the procurement world. So how have you found it, Christoph?
Yeah, no, that sounds good. Yeah, I guess one of the topics that we always seem to bring up in each podcast is how important is procurement within the organization, and where should procurement sit at the table? And in the case of a pandemic like COVID-19, you know, it ought to become even more important.
You would think so.
You're dealing with supply issues, you're dealing with transportation issues, you're dealing with logistic issues, we are dealing with price increase from suppliers, you're dealing with products no longer available that you need to find an alternative in a market where it's really becoming difficult to find someone to talk to in the first place, because a lot of people are either, you know, let go or they work from home. It's a completely different set of rules, and it happens so fast. And to me, there's so many areas that we can talk about. And like Andy, like you say, we would love to hear from you know, people in different industry, different geographies, different countries, different line of services and products, and see how they cope with one of the first topic is, you know, the first thing, working from home. And in the case of procurement, working from home sounds pretty nice, but after a while it may not be as efficient as effective as working within a work environment. What do you think, Andy?
Well, yeah, I think initially, if somebody said to me, "Oh, you don't have to have that morning commute, you can avoid the rush hour traffic going over the Sydney Harbour Bridge," I'll have bitten your hand off. And you know, what you mean? I can just lounge around at home in my tracksuit bottoms and make purchasing decisions from the comfort of my home office. Yeah, it sounds good, but you're absolutely right, Christoph. I think whilst the way that people seem to have managed, particularly in a Microsoft Teams or Zoom world that we're currently experiencing, has been pretty phenomenal, and people are managing to keep some levels of communication, working from home can present numerous challenges, not only from a focus point of view, from the individual perspective, but also from a data point of view and an intelligence point of view. And the two things are slightly different. I mean, data, yeah, we can crunch numbers and look at supply demand curves and understand what we're trying to achieve. But the intelligence aspect is almost like the water cooler moment, and I'm really getting to understand what the potential nuances are within any procurement relationship. And they can be not only externally, but also those internal clients that you have. And whether it's an opportunity, I mean, quite often what happens in the office is there could be a sort of a clear position. So we must have X. The new car fleet has got to look like this, or the new travel deal has got to look like this, or the card and paper component that I'm buying has got to be of this specification. But those subtle conversations can build a bit of flexibility into the potential outcome, which in turn can give procurement opportunities to flex the creative muscle a bit more, whereas Zoom calls are pretty, I think they're certainly better than a phone call and much better than an email, but they still, there's that slight barrier where people can be, well, we need it to be like this, and, oh, sorry, I've got to go, I'm on another Zoom call, as opposed to, do you really need it to be like that? Does it really need to be this specification, whatever it is you're buying,
It comes down to, how fast can we make decision? And at best of time, decisions are pretty slow to be made sometimes within organizations. And working remote, while you can argue the point that, working remote, you're not disturbed by someone asking you to go down for a coffee every 5 minutes, you can do pretty much put your head down and work really hard. But when it comes to decision, you need to involve other people. And it's more than one person usually. And decision making, what I will be interested in to hear from people coming on the podcast is, has decision making been impacted in terms of, has it been better or has it been worse? Has it taken longer to make a decision or is it quicker now?
Well, I think that's a fascinating thing and I think I've seen with a couple of organisations that I've been working with, certainly one, the decision-making process seems to be very clear and very very precise, and maybe it is because sort of the background data has been available and as you say, people are able to get their head down a bit more. Whereas in the other organisation that I've been working for, there's been a real desire to be exceptionally collaborative, to the extent that maybe the firm hand at the controls has been loosened slightly, and more people are allowed to have an input, and the scope for the procurement requirement has broadened, whereas in the other instance it's narrowed, it is very specific. And some of that's been driven by supply and demand issues.
On that topic, Andy, supply and demand, in the case of pandemics, there's obviously less market demand. And as you know, when you set up a contract, suppliers like to know how much they're going to get in terms of revenue and how much they need to produce. And both parties try to hold themselves accountable to the volume versus the pricing and all this. In the case of lower demand, you pretty much put those contracts, at the window, because the demand has gone down by, a huge amount of volume. And so the pricing may no longer be, adequate. And how did procurement people dealt with adjusting contracts with, in effect, are no longer a promise to act as per the rules that we both parties agreed, and those prices might shoot up straight up the roof, straight up, because the volumes are so much lower, and that is only if the suppliers can actually supply. It could be cases where the supplier says, "Sorry, but I can't do it." And but just on the first point, lower demand, higher prices, all contracts no longer being, valid anymore. That's a massive, massive area to talk about.
And I would imagine for a number of people in the procurement environment, particularly for those who it's a first or second senior role, they may not have experienced conditions. Well, let's be honest, nobody has experienced conditions like this in terms of the pandemic from a historical perspective. There is no relevant data to compare against. However, from a, you know, a supply and demand issue, for some procurement people, the fact that it has shifted from a buyer's market to a seller's market, and from a particularly whether we're talking about freight or haulage, you know, that's, you know, one of the bigger components. So it's all very well being able to buy the product, but can you get it? Can you ship it from China or from Hong Kong or from Singapore or wherever, to wherever it needs to be? You know, the price of the product might not have changed, but the price of shipping it may well have increased by 15, 20, goodness knows percent. And it would be fascinating to understand from people new to it how, as you say, the contracts are all very well, but if people cannot buy the raw materials to produce whatever it is that is required, because the cost of skyrocketed so much.
That's right. And the cost of the transport, the disruption, the fact that all the delays has an implication on the inventory management and what you're able to promise to the market. That has an impact on marketing and how hard marketing is deciding to push or no longer push a certain product, because there's no point in promising something you cannot deliver. You know, all those implications brings back the conversation that we have throughout all the podcasts, is whether procurement should have a better seat at the table, because obviously it's super important then.
Absolutely. And I can't help but think it does increase the relevance and importance, and hopefully the more progressive organisations will be taking that on board and involving, or at least getting the involvement of the procurement function at a far deeper level, and ideally at a board level, because these are, you know, some key decisions. And it's all very well a CEO or a chief operating officer declaring X must happen, but if X can't happen because of the market conditions, they need procurement to share that information, and also to come in with some replacement strategies, because I don't know if that happens enough, to be honest.
Yeah, and remember, I think I mentioned that that sentence before, that saying that says it's bad to pay too much, but it's worth to pay too little. And in the case of, you know, save, get the best deal possible, you effectively give less profit to a supplier. And in the case of a pandemic like this, suppliers are struggling as well. And so if you remove, you know, too much profit from their own bottom line, then those suppliers don't have, you know, the way to support their clients as well. So it comes back to, shall we pay, you know, a little bit more in case we have an event like this again in the future? So it probably brings back the, you know, the discussions or the pricing or the criteria that you put on pricing perhaps shouldn't be as important as, you know, trying to get the best rock bottom deal from suppliers.
Absolutely. And I think it'll be very interesting to know whether those organizations and procurement functions that have striven to drive a more holistic relationship with their suppliers are actually seeing the benefit of it, because it might well be that they haven't been caning their suppliers on price for the past, you know, 5 years. They've come to a more balanced perspective where they say, look, we want you to make greater margin on this. We want to find ways for us to be more efficient, to enable whatever it is you charge to be us to be absorbed in a way that doesn't hit our bottom line. And I would be fascinated to know, having set up a few deals in the past where there's been a greater element of actually we want you to make money, you need to make money, because in times of crisis we expect you to honor our agreements first, and I would be intrigued to know. I mean, also one of the things that this highlights and brings to mind is where companies who are nothing really more than pure middlemen who don't actually who are procurement stopgaps in between the space where they can't add any value because they're literally taking margin out of it. And I referred earlier to the UK energy market and six or so, maybe more at this time of talking, companies have already gone to the wall. And they were literally, they were buying gas at one price and then selling it onto the market at another price. And they weren't involved in producing it or anything. They were literally, they were creaming some margin from it. And they had, you know, as soon as the prices started to go up, they had nowhere to go because they weren't adding any value. And it'd be fascinating to see whether that aspect of procurement will actually potentially lose out, and whether it's the direct companies and the direct relationships that will ultimately extract greater value from the situation.
And when the price goes up for freight costs, for example, or raw material because there's a shortage, in the case of COVID-19, who pays for it? Is it the supplier? Is it the buyer? Is there a conversation between the two? Are they splitting? Are they splitting evenly? How are they passing, you know, how are they making the whole supply chain still working by sharing the load, and to what level? You know, that I'll be interested in hearing about how companies are dealing with, you know, price increases from, you know, products or logistic manufacturing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, it'd be fascinating to understand that. And, you know, invariably what happens in this situation is, you know, the people within the supply chain will try to intuitively work together if they've got shared goals. But the additional costs invariably get passed on to the end purchaser. And the challenge there is, are you going to price yourself out of the market? And how do you control that to an extent where, our costs have gone up, therefore we're passing. And in an industry that's close to my heart, in the newspaper industry, occasionally you would see sort of once or twice a year, or once a year most probably, you say due to an increase in paper costs or raw material for pulp and paper costs, unfortunately your copy of, you know, whatever newspaper it is going up by five pence to reflect that increase. Fascinating, you know, from my perspective, is that every time the paper cost went down, that saving was never passed on to the reader. But that's inevitable. But is that going to be something that people might get? You know, it's very rare, unless you get a new entrant into the same market, do a particular product's price go down unless they've reduced the quality or reduced the quantity within that. So whether you used to get, I don't know, 20 Maltesers in a packet, you now only get 18, but you're still charged the same amount. Is that what's going to happen going forward? Or will people be able to say, okay, our prices have gone up this amount because there's an increase in shipping. However, when the shipping costs revert back to pre-COVID conditions, if that ever happens, then we will reduce our costs accordingly. Highly unlikely.
One of the we did a lot of work helping, you know, consolidate spend with clients, and very often you end up with one, two, potentially three major suppliers. In a case of a pandemic like COVID-19, then suddenly that one or two suppliers that's you become super reliant on maybe, you know, going out of business or maybe having difficulties, and you found yourself that, you know, dealing with one or two suppliers to achieve economies of scales is actually hurting you. That's one point. The second point is, how much of your products or parts or materials that you purchase is strategic, meaning how much of those products are coming from overseas that then can be impacted by a number of different things as we've seen with COVID-19. And perhaps there is another way of you know, addressing strategic products, strategic materials within an organization, where you say, look, We could get it cheaper overseas, but if we were to repeat COVID-19 with COVID-20 or COVID-21 or whatever the number is, maybe we shouldn't make the same mistake twice and start developing our own manufacturing capabilities or on projects locally. So if there was a case, we can lean back on supplier number two or supplier number three, that is, you know, where the product is locally, you know, locally produced. And in the case of Australia, I think there's a high reliance on overseas supplies, and that's dangerous, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid observation, and certainly I'm seeing in particular in one of the particular businesses I'm currently working with is that there's this very strong reliance on the Chinese market, and it's, you know, very competitive and very good quality. That being said, the shipping costs are becoming quite prohibitive, and it's certainly the gap is closing between what's available in Shanghai the same in terms of, you know, what's available in Sydney. So, you know, whilst the raw material and workforce costs, labour costs are higher here, the fact that the shipping costs are increasing significantly has started to open up close the gap. One of the key things we're doing is a strategic review of what the capabilities are in Australia, and should we be investing in an Australian business to actually fill that gap. And one of the big challenges there is something we haven't really touched on in the procurement podcast quite so much, and something I know we're both keen to look at over the next 12 months, is procurement and the environment. And you can certainly see what the potential impact of reducing the amount of shipping coming in and looking to produce here in Australia. And whether the challenge there is, you know, are the raw materials available here in Australia to produce the product? Because if they're not, then, well, you're just, you know, you're potentially shipping a heavier element over here to produce something that you could have got produced in China for even greater.
That's right. There's the raw material availability, but also the know-how and whether or not we have a skilled workforce, or that workforce has totally vanished because no one has been needing to produce those raw material over the last 10, 20 years. That's a massive. Another point I wanted to bring up is, are we going to fall back? Now the economy is in shock mode and we're trying to do the best that we can. You know, we talk about all the good things, locally manufactured and not reliant so much on overseas market and all those good things. But are we going to slip back into our old ways of dealing and still chasing the lowest possible price down the track, you think? Or is this a lesson and we're going to actually learn from it and not repeat it?
I think that's a fascinating question. I already know what the CFO's answer to that is.
I think I know too.
And that's where the fight to get a CPO on the board at board level to have a clearer view around that. I think, again, I mentioned this before about the more progressive organisations. I would like to think that there would certainly be a criteria there. There are still those businesses who, if there's a range of options for them, they'll just go for the cheapest. And if that company goes bust, they will then go on to the next cheapest. And if that company goes bust, etc., etc.
It goes back to the level of competition within an industry and whether or not you're forced to go to cheapest. But having worked with so many organizations over the last 25 years or so, there's so many ways to save money and not necessarily based on price. And price is the easy one. That's what's visible. But there's better ways to save on cost and save on costs.
Absolutely.
For a long time. Eliminating cost, I'm talking
about. Yeah, and some of it's down to, the quality and caliber of communication is a, potential way of eliminating cost as opposed, from both sides of the coin. And if you can, if I can make it cheaper for a supplier to interact with my organization, I would like to see that reflected in the price. If we're more efficient in dealing with the ordering process, if we're more efficient in dealing with the labeling or the whatever it might be, there's always those opportunities.
It has to, that level of communication needs to happen internally, but also at the suppliers, which reminds me, in my early days, I used to work with a person called Michael Doyle. He wrote the American Keiretsu book. That was prior to my Coopers & Lybrand and Pricewaterhouse days in New York. And his philosophy or his way of looking at the procurement and the supply chain was to work with the extended supply chain all the way down to the raw material, if possible, but at least two or three levels down. And I remember we did a study for Bosch where we were looking at the ABS brake system. And we mapped the entire supply chain and we called it down to level two, down to level three, as down to the raw material as much as we could. And it was fascinating that dealing with the suppliers that Bosch were dealing with, no one had any idea of supplier number two, supplier number three, let alone supplier number four. They had no idea they were actually dealing with Bosch. And so it brings back to how much communication and how far and how transparent organizations are willing to go to have supply chain competing against supply chain by saying, look, we've tried before and we try to squeeze everything, but there's better outcome in actually working together. And not just me, the buyer, and you, the seller, but you, the seller, acting as a buyer from you. On suppliers and so on and so forth, as far as possible we could do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the only way to bring innovation into the marketplace, in my view.
Yeah, well, exactly. I completely concur with that as the most appropriate way. It's interesting. You remember when we had the conversation over a couple of years ago with the head of procurement for the ABC here in Australia, and she was looking at the sort of, for want of the wage slaves, for want of a better phrase, in terms of just, are people being working in inappropriate conditions? Are they being paid for these jobs? And it's that the supplier, three stages removed. And from my experience, we used to, from the magazine business, we would go into the forest in Scandinavia and meet with the loggers and the people who are planting the trees to understand what their cost challenges were. And whilst we were still at the whim of the general industry dynamics, it was important to understand that in whichever Finnish forest we happened to be, that the challenges were buying the new logging equipment, or that the icebreakers were required to enable the ships to get out of harbour, and what the impact of that was, and the icebreakers they were being hit because marine fuel was costing more, and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's an essential part of what procurement can be, and the opportunities are manifold. And as we've said, it'd be fascinating to hear from listeners to the procurement podcast around that. I know we've got a couple of interviews with people from around the globe lined up over the next few weeks and months. But we'd certainly like to hear a lot more from them. And this podcast, to be honest, could go on for another 2 hours and we wouldn't be covering the same ground. But it's, from your perspective, Christoph, maybe to wrap this up and to also to point people in the direction of how to get hold of us.
That's right, yeah. Just just before I mention this, there's you know, we talk about setting up procurement strategy and, you know, putting a procurement plan to enable that strategy, and that is a challenge in itself in some of the organizations. But shall we have a third element, which is a procurement crisis, you know, type strategy? If everything goes, you know, almost like a simulation of if things go bad again, what do we do? And so when they do go bad, we don't act in a crisis. We don't act, you know, in a reactive way. And to me, that's something the organization should, you know, look into. Simulate something. Simulate the worst that can happen. What do you do?
Exactly. Well, we're sort of seeing that. I mean, I have mentioned the UK and the gas problems that they've had with general fuel, and there are fuel shortages and long queues at petrol stations. Hopefully, by the time this podcast is out, that will have been overcome. But it's interesting that the government would have been trying to blame that on the pandemic, and then they're trying to blame it on the fact that with the world started to gear up again, it's actually a fact that there's been an increase in demand and the supply isn't able to meet it. And then there's been the political component of Russia being accused of delaying the fuel coming into the West.
Once you get into that topic, you never know what is right
exactly,
and what is wrong.
Yeah.
We are so far too removed. But what we can do is, within the organization that we are close to or work within, I think the best that we can possibly do at an individual level and within the team is something that is visible that we can do.
You don't get the visibility. I think you're absolutely right. And it depends who you ask in that same situation. Some people will blame it on Brexit. Some people will blame it on sunspots, you know, whatever it is.
You want to hear a funny story? We were in a restaurant, Italian restaurant, maybe 5-6 years ago, and the restaurant was pretty empty. And I asked the waitress, what's going on? Why is there nobody? The food is delicious. And she said, oh, it's the global economy. So she didn't mention about local marketing or putting flyers on people's, you know, door or cars or inviting people through social media or having special deal. They blamed it on
the global economy, yeah. And
on the global economy, it's so much easier to, you know, to do that way. But, you know, like you say, we would love to hear from people with, you know, the input, different geography, different industries, different line of work, working remotely, working with suppliers, how you dealt with price increases, shortages, you know.
Absolutely.
Transportation, logistic, and all that.
And how best can people contact us, Christoph?
That's right, yeah. So that's pretty simple. info@procurementpodcast.com. That's info, I-N-F-O, at procurementpodcast.com.
Perfect. Well, that sounds like a fantastic invitation. Do take us up on it. We'd love to hear from you. As I say, Christoph and I are looking forward to a flurry of podcasts coming your way with people from around the globe. I know we've got a couple lined up, which will be interesting. But if you'd like to get involved and to share your insights or your stories or, you know, horror stories or success stories, we'd really appreciate it. Because, you know, we believe passionately in the power of procurement. We think that there's a huge amount of value and good that procurement can do, and we'd like to hear from people who agree with that, or equally happy to hear from people who think that that's not the way things are.
That's right. Andy, we did very well. We're only about 13 minutes past the 20 minutes we set, so it's not so bad. You know, it could be worse.
Well done, us. So that's brilliant. Thank you all very much for listening, and don't forget to get in touch with us via info@procurementpodcast.com.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph. For more information, please visit our website, procurementpodcast.com, and feel free to email us your questions at info@procurementpodcast.com.